Thank you. So we haven't seen Andrew for a while. It's been, what did you say, 15 months? 15 months, yeah. And that's not because we haven't asked. He just has not been able to come. He's been busy doing other things. So I love your life. I'm so glad to see you again. And thank you so much for opening our hearts with your beautiful music. You're just wonderful, supported by our wonderful band as well. Thank you. So I just want to say a few words that are not actually planned to be part of the sermon, just to sort of let you know where I am this morning. Some of you know what is going on with me, and some of you don't. If you're on Facebook, you know that we had a death in our animal family, and our big rabbit, Bigfoot, passed away. Thank you. And I was offered, somebody offered to speak for me today. Carol Lotz actually called me and said she would speak for me if I didn't want to show up. But the message that I send by being here is that I know that I can be in sorrow and joy at the same time, and that it's all the beauty and fabric of life, and that love and loss is becoming one and the same to me, that we lose and we feel the loss because we love so deeply. So that's why I'm here speaking this morning, and also because I know that I love all of you. And even being here backstage at the beginning has been incredibly therapeutic when Peter told me I looked like Julie Andrews and I should come on the stage with this. And then I was telling them that I'm wearing my, I don't know if I can do this elegantly, but I'm wearing my you're not seeing anything, are you? My crucifixion, I call these my crucifixion sandals because they are the actual sandals that Jesus wore. They hurt my feet, but it's getting better. But you see what I'm talking about? Love and joy and loss and sorrow, and all of it is just intertwined in this beautiful fabric of existence. And so I'm dedicating this service today to all of us and to my bunny Bigfoot, who died too soon, and I'll be talking about him later. So the name of this talk today is How Do You Repel Your Good? I'm sure you're all curious because you probably have way too much good and you'd like to get rid of some of it, right? There's actually truth to that statement, that we have abundant and infinite good that is available to us, and yet we seem to have a knack for pushing it away. And isn't that weird that we have this knack for pushing our good away when probably we would love to receive more and more and infinite good, because good is the nature of God. Let me read you this quote from Ernest Holmes that addresses this. This is from How to Live the Science of Mind. And Dr. Holmes says, "The will of God is toward the more abundant life, because that life expresses God. The life that is cramped, warped, timid, and fearful does not express the divine being as completely as the free self-expression of the soul, pronouncing God's work to be good and announcing through every experience the ecstasy of self-expression." That's why I'm calling my class Ecstatic Prayer, because I think that we have and we deserve to be in ecstasy, even if it's the ecstasy of agony, even if it's joy and sorrow intertwined. We are these divine beings that have a great life here for us, and we can have that great life, and we can be in a state of delight and ecstasy and wonder all of the time if we choose it. And that's the thing, we have to choose it through the power of our thoughts and our emotions, and which ultimately means through the power of our belief. So it seems that often we do not choose it. We choose to push away our good. And I'm going to have Hugh come up here and read a story from, he'll tell you where it's from, but it's about how we repel our good. You're going to say where it's from, right? Okay, good. So this is my husband, Hugh. I call him Gramps, but you can call him Hugh. I'm sorry.
Not usually. Sometimes. This is from Living the Science of Mind by Ernest Holmes. In the Colorado Rockies, there is a beautiful valley from which fountains gush forth. Each fountain is different. More water comes from some than from others. But there is only one body of water at the deep subterranean level which flows through each of them. Each fountain is supplied from this body of water, and the water that gushes through each has a pressure within itself that causes it to flow with an irresistible force. This may be likened to our own spiritual natures. We as individuals each have our own thoughts, feelings, hopes, aspirations, and desires, and each is directly and intimately connected with the one divine life, energy, and power. Each of us is a fountain of life. There is a God pressure back of each one of us, a life force seeking outlet through our thoughts and acts. One of the most remarkable sayings of Jesus was that he of himself could do nothing. It is the Father, Mother that dwelleth within me that doeth the works. Could we not say of each fountain up there in the Rockies that the fountain of itself could do nothing because it is merely an outlet for the pressure back of it? Let us personalize these fountains and give each one the power to block the flow of water through it. One fountain might say, well, I don't know whether there is water enough. I am not quite certain that I am an outlet for this great ocean of water. I am not even certain that I believe there is enough pressure to keep it on flowing. Perhaps it will stop tomorrow. Another fountain might say, I am so confused over everything. I am so uncertain about everything that I have come to the point where I really don't know what's going to happen. And another fountain might be so filled with fear and distrust that it would block its own channel, while still another might get jealous of the other fountains and gradually come to hate them. Let us make believe that these mental attitudes of the fountains could actually stop the flow of water through them. Would that not be about the way all of us are at times? We become so frustrated with our thoughts and fears and doubts that it makes it impossible for us to let God flow through us with the joy of life. Our problem is not with God, who is the river of life. It is not with the divine pressure that seeks to express itself through us. Our trouble is with ourselves. Each one of us is an inlet to the divine, because we are individuals, we can inhibit its flow. We can block it or squeeze it down to a small volume or even stop it. Or by opening up all the channels of faith and conviction and hope, we can increase its flow. When the natural joy of life is unblocked, it will flow freely through us and we shall become whole and happy. And we don't have to try to be fountains on our own. Each one of us is rooted in God. There is a power greater than we are, a flow in our lives from a divine source. And so it is.
So it is. Thank you. That's great, Hugh. Thank you. I knew you'd do a great job with that. I liked all the voices of the different fountains, right? Yeah, so I guess, you know, you get the point, is that we are part of this divine flow. We are outlets and inlets for this divine flow, and yet we get in the way. So the reason for this talk of how do we repel our good, how to reject and repel our good, is for us to just identify ways that we might be getting in the way of our good. And usually it's, we have a choice. We can be getting in the way of good, or we can be the way of good. And so I'd love it if everybody here could just make one tiny 1% shift in consciousness this morning that helps us be the way of our good versus in the way of our good. I think that one of the most major ways that we get in the way of our good is through judgment of reality, and also believing that our judgment is reality. You know, in this center, I talk a lot about absolute reality, and absolute reality is that place, that wholeness beyond all opinions, beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, where the world is something beyond what we can even imagine. But what we tend to do is that we have a thought about reality that is only partially true, and we make it entirely true. We have a thought, thus we have a thought about reality that isn't real. Anytime we're judging, anytime we're guilty, anytime we're being critical, Anytime we are feeling resentful, anytime we are feeling fearful, chances are we are having a thought about reality that isn't real. One of my favorite stories about this comes from the work of Dr. Michael Beckwith, who I heard him tell this story when I was at a seminar where he was speaking. And this was right after he had made the movie The Secret. And he was at LAX, and he's an African-American male, and he was loading his baggage and getting his ticket and all of that, and he noticed that there were two police officers looking at him. Michael Beckwith also he's very open about this, he had a checkered past. He he was involved in an entrepreneurial activity of an illegal nature. He had a marijuana empire before it was legal. Let's just put it that way, okay? So he saw these cops looking at him, and he thought, oh boy, here we go. What's going to happen? And they were looking at him, and they were whispering, and they were pointing. And he was thinking they were going to come and search him or frisk him or make him lie down or, you know, do something, arrest him in some way, because he was bringing the past and race consciousness into the picture of the present moment. And what happened was that the cops finally approached him, and as they approached him, he got more and more nervous, more and more thinking that thought about reality that he had, and one of the cops said, "Say, weren't you in that movie, The Secret?" "My wife loves that movie. Can I have your autograph?" And that was it. And when Michael tells that story, he says, "I had a thought about reality that wasn't true, or a thought about reality that wasn't real." So think about it. Think about a time that you may be in fear, that you may be in judgment, that you may be in resentment, and wonder to yourself, is it possible that there is a bigger picture here? Is it possible? Hugh says it is possible. Is it possible that there is a bigger picture here that I'm not seeing? Because, what we do, you know, I can imagine Michael doing this when the cops were looking at him and he was having that thought about reality that wasn't real. He was saying, no, this is real. This is real because of my past and because of what I know about society. This is real. We have a thought about reality that isn't real, and then we justify it. We say, I deserve to think this way, and you most certainly do, but it may be blocking your experience of good. You know, one of my experiences with this, I struggle with judgment of others sometimes. Anybody else? Well, I saw one person raise her hand, and a lot of people laughed sheepishly. So you and I maybe can go to reform school after church. One of my friends, as you know, I think I've said this before, one of my friends who's a minister says that we prayerfully judge others. And I do struggle with judging others sometimes. And back in my former church, there was this practitioner, when I was a practitioner, that I didn't like. I think I was that fountain that was kind of jealous and resentful. I felt like she was getting more attention than me, and I didn't like it. Isn't that holy? Isn't that just so spiritual? And I went to an event, and it was a party and a reception, and I ended up speaking with her for about an hour and had a great time talking to her, and then afterwards I was like, darn it, I forgot to resent her. I forgot to be disdainful. I forgot to judge her. You know, so in my judgment, I had this whole list of things about her that I thought were true, my thoughts about reality that were not true, and then it was shattered through my forgetfulness to hold on to that list and this conversation that we had, and I had a whole bigger picture of what she is really like. You know, and I believe that is true for everybody, that if we are in judgment of something or someone, if we are not accepting life on its own terms, if we are not accepting that life gets to be life and that God gets to be God, then chances are, you see how I won't really commit to that? Chances are, okay, definitely we are only seeing a part of the picture because God is good. God is what Ernest Holmes said. God is goodness wanting to express through us, and we get to be the divine outlet for that good, that the inlet for the good that forms within us, and then we get to be the outlet for that good that expresses in the world and inspires others to find their good and their grace and their wonder as well. For me, it always starts with the way that I view reality, this idea that I am constantly making up thoughts about reality that are not real, and claiming that they are real, and defending their right to be real, and telling other people that they are real, and getting people to collude with me on the reality of these thoughts that I have that are not real. So if I am able to step back and take a bigger look at reality, that is extremely helpful to me. I've been listening, you know, I'm getting ready to teach this class on prayer and meditation, and one of the disciplines that I'm doing for it is to listen to a YouTube every day, a YouTube, and primarily by a spiritual teacher named Rupert Spira, S-P-I-R-A. I think my friend Brother Jeff is here. Yeah, there he is. He's the one who started me on this. Has anybody heard of Rupert Spira? It's a wonderful non-dual teacher. Oh, Chris, yay. Okay, wonderful non-dual teacher. And, you know, I love the way that he explains reality, and I'm going to give it my best shot. But basically, what he says is that, and this is not different than the science of mind, but it's helpful sometimes to hear it in different terms. He says that everything is consciousness or awareness. Everything is consciousness. And consciousness creates existence out of itself. Consciousness actually has to sacrifice something to become existence. Consciousness has to constrict itself into matter to become existence. And this is a bit of a sacrifice for consciousness. Not in a bad way, but in a good way. It is very similar to the fall from grace, that everything was peace and consciousness and love, and then Adam and Eve ate from the tree of duality, right? And that was a constriction. Then things changed, right? Adam had to labor by the sweat of his brow, and Eve had to have pain in childbirth and what have you, right? Get that? Childbirth. One of these days, well, never mind. Just never mind. I'm not even going to say that. Okay. So, and it's also like, you know, many of you who were raised Christian or Catholic have heard the phrase that Christ died for our sins, right? What that means to me in terms of the constriction of consciousness is that wholeness, vastness became small so that we could find our way back to vastness, so that we could have the joy of finding our way back to vastness. Wholeness created the illusion of separation so that we could return to wholeness and experience the homecoming of that, because we are homesick for wholeness. And we want to have that experience of returning to wholeness, which makes it deeper and sweeter. And consciousness did this so that it could experience it through us, could experience the return through us. Are you getting this? Is this making sense, sort of? Okay, it'll make more sense in just a minute. It's also the idea of from the Sufis that love is a hidden treasure that longs to be known, and it creates the world so that it can know itself through the return of the belief in separation to the belief in wholeness, right? The part that made a lot of sense to me, though, that came from Rupert Spira was that he likened it to a rubber ball, and I'm gonna say a Nerf ball. Nerf balls are from my day. Anybody remember Nerf balls? Are they still around? Well, good to know. You're a teacher. You should know. Okay, good to know. So you know that if you squish a Nerf ball, the Nerf ball sacrifices its original shape, and the Nerf ball has a yearning. As soon as you take your hands away from it, it has a yearning to pop back into its original state, right? That's how they still are, Dina? Okay, good. So that's the gist. Any squishy thing like that will want to pop back into its original state. And he likens that to consciousness. He likens that to consciousness, that consciousness has been compressed, and yet there is this yearning in existence to expand back into the awareness of everything is consciousness. And the way that he says that we expand back into that yearning is through bliss, through joy. Sat-chit-ananda. Existence, consciousness, and bliss. So we find our bliss, we find our joy, and that is the outlet through which Spirit wants to express through us. And part of our bliss is identifying where we are getting in the way of our good, where we are judging, where we are resenting, where we are fearful, where we are doubtful, where we are guilty, and applying a process to that that transforms that separation into bliss, the bliss that returns us to wholeness and the awareness that everything is consciousness. Rupert Spira suggests something, but first I want to talk a little bit about the science of mind teaching and the way it has been in the past. Many of you have been in this teaching for a while, and you may remember the days when somebody would say something negative, and you would say, don't put that out there, right? Remember that? Anybody remember that? Don't say that. Don't put that out there. Or sometimes people would go, cancel, cancel, cancel. I remember saying that once when I was coming down with a cold, and the people I was with said, cancel, cancel, cancel. And I was fine, but they all got colds, so I don't know. I don't know what was up with that. I was just identifying something that I knew I needed to address. And so we're in a place now in this movement where we're getting, I think, more mature about, you know, Ernest Holmes says that God is only good and God is only grace and God is only joy. And we also are able to identify the opposite of all of that goodness without giving it an undue amount of power. If we pretend it's not there, then we are giving it a tremendous amount of power. It's so big that we can't even look at it. So you know, and they call that spiritual bypass. You've probably heard that term, where you're pretending that things are not distressing. And then we started talking about spiritual bypass, and we started trying to heal spiritual bypass. And my observation has been that people will say, okay, I'm not going to spiritual bypass this feeling of shame or this feeling of guilt. I'm going to feel it. Okay, I felt it. Now I can go on and do some more bypassing, right? People feel it once. What I recommend more is kind of what I said at the beginning, of being able to walk in this world where we can simultaneously feel joy and sorrow and recognize the two are intertwined. And Brother Rupert Spira, I think, offers a good remedy for that, a good way to do that. He says, if something is distressing you, if something is blocking your good, if you are able to first identify where you are feeling guilty, shameful, afraid, doubtful, where you are feeling resentment, where you are feeling judgment, where you are feeling lack, any of those things, if you are able to first identify that, then turn away from it. As Ernest Holmes says, turn entirely away from the problem and look to the I am, look to the consciousness that there is a power and a presence that created you, but that also created this constricted situation in your life. You are constricting for the purpose of expanding eventually. So turn away from it and become one. I am remembering who I am. Become one with that blissful, beautiful consciousness of wholeness. Now, in the old days, we would stop there. But Rupert Spira suggests that we turn back to the thing that is causing us distress and then welcome it. Welcome it. Welcome it and allow it to be. And what I see in that is that, again, it is not turning away from it and giving it so much power that we can't even look at it. It is diminishing its power because we are willing to welcome it and say, yes, this is part of the kingdom of heaven too, the kingdom of heaven on earth that is at hand, according to Brother Jesus, right? The kingdom of heaven is at hand. The kingdom of heaven is on earth. The kingdom of heaven is taking place in each and every one of us. So we turn away from the problem and get grounded in our I am presence, and then the I am presence that is so big and so beautiful and blissful turns back and welcomes whatever is happening. And we say to ourselves, he suggests that we say to ourselves, can I live with this as it is? Kind of a harsh question, because most of us want to change everything, right? But he says, ask that question, can I live with this as it is, and see what happens. And that's where paradox tends to take over. Because as soon as we start welcoming, as soon as we stop resisting, as soon as we lose our attachment to things being a certain way, that opens up spaciousness for the mystery. It's the third force, right? It's the opposing factor, the affirming factor, what we do with it, and then something great comes through in this opening up to a greater way to be, simply by saying, can I live with this, or am I willing to live with this as it is? You know, and certainly, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, there is grief and there is trauma in life. There is tragedy. There are challenges in the world that are difficult to live with. There are challenges in our personal lives. You know, I think a lot of you, when I mentioned that our beautiful pet had passed away, you know, you felt that pain. You felt the pain that I was feeling, and perhaps you have your own pets and your own loved ones, and they have passed away, and it's been a difficult experience for you. You know, with Bigfoot, Biggie, our rabbit, you know, I remember we've only had him for about, I don't know, 9 months or so, and he was young. He died way too young, and the vet really doesn't know what happened to him. We pulled him back for the brink of death, and then he was fine for a while, and then he passed away. But I remember saying to Hugh one time, don't you love his long eyelashes? And Hugh said, I love everything about him. So we really loved him a lot, and it was really, really sad to lose this sweet bunny way too young. And yet, I'm doing this process because I'm writing this talk, and it's like, can you practice what you preach for once? No, I'm kidding. Just threw that in there. The hills are alive. Okay. Okay. Can you practice what you preach and just practice turning to that I Am presence, that place that says that there is no death? You know, the Islamic teaching says there is no God but God, meaning that there is nothing other than God, and there is no prayer but prayer, and there is no life but life. There is only life. Can you turn to that place and recognize that there is no death? And yes, at the same time, there is this feeling of loss in your life, so turn to that and look at it and say, can I live with this? Can I live with this as it is? Can I live in a world where there is life and death? And I went up in the mountains, I was hiking with my dogs, and I spoke to the vet, and in the mountains, you know, that were burnt to a crisp 2 years ago, the flowers and the greenery is just amazing. I saw painted lady butterflies fluttering around, you know, and I just saw all this evidence of life that sprang out of death. And I looked at my relationship with my animals and my families and saw how important it was to me. And I looked at all of the love that I've been receiving on Facebook and all of the condolences from people that have been writing to me and just the outpouring of love and compassion and understanding that wouldn't have been there, that isn't there for any of us unless we go through something that warrants that type of outpouring. So yes, I can live with a world where there is life and death. I know that life and death are essential to being. Life and death are part of this essential contraction of this subject-object split that allows consciousness to look at itself and then re-experience itself through being born to wholeness, being born again to wholeness. I don't think I would want to live in a world where there wasn't life and death, because death makes life precious. And as Brother Norm reminded me when he wrote to me, that love is just so eager to love that it will go through all kinds of things in order to evoke even more love. It'll even give us loss. It'll even give us sorrow. It'll even give us tragedy, just so we can experience more love. And don't you think that's what everything is about, really? You know, we talk about resentment. We talk about blame. We talk about guilt. We talk about shame. We talk about fear. We talk about doubt. We talk about lack. All of that is what is getting in the way of our experience of more love. And the thing is that it feels so good to the ego to have all of these things going on for us, right? Doesn't it? Am I wrong? No, I'm not wrong. Don't even answer that. I know I'm not wrong. It feels very satisfying to the ego to do that, to judge others, to judge ourselves even, to judge life and to refuse to accept life on its own terms. But if we just let go, if we let go, then that creates room for the miraculous. That creates room for the bliss. That creates room for the experience of the divine that is so much more powerful, because consciousness chose to be existence, and existence returns to the awareness that everything is consciousness through bliss. Satchitananda. Om Satchitananda. So, what will you do about this? Now you've heard the news. You've heard the news. You are committed now. You are committed. I declare that you are committed, that we are committed to looking at the places where we are blocking our good, to looking at the places where we are getting in the way of our good, and turning to the great I Am, recognizing, first of all, that we are having a thought about reality that is not real, no matter how real we want to make it. There is a bigger picture that is waiting to emerge. And so we turn to the I Am presence, and then we turn back to the feeling and the condition in our bodies and our emotions and our hearts and our minds and our beings, and we say, am I willing to live with this as it is? And as we become willing to live with it, that's when the third force takes over. That's when the reconciliation factor happens. That's when something miraculous starts to emerge for us. We have to be aware. We have to be awake. We have to do the work. And most of all, we have to support one another and love each other, because we're all simply returning to a greater experience of love. Let us love one another right now. Let us pray. You're welcome.